today on Against the Grain. While New York City may be the capital of wealth in America, the celebrated metropolis has been a locus of rebellion. From the revolt of the Native American Munsee against the Dutch, to slave uprisings, class and race riots, Stonewall, protests against the Republican National Convention, Occupy Wall Street and Black Lives Matter, and much more, New York City has exploded almost every decade for over 400 years. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with geographer Don Mitchell about the history and possible future of rebellion in New York. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The history of New York City is one of near constant rebellion. As my guest today writes, it's almost as if social peace is the exception, a small island of calm in an always churning sea. Yet most chronicles of the city paper over that history. To set the record straight, Don Mitchell has edited, with the late Neil Smith and a fleet of contributors, a fascinating historical geography of upheaval in that metropolis. It's called Revolting New York, How 400 Years of Riot, Rebellion, Uprising, and Revolution Shaped a City, and it's published by the University of Georgia Press. Mitchell is professor of cultural geography at Uppsala University in Sweden and professor emeritus at Syracuse University. Don, New York represents both the pinnacle of wealth and power in the U.S., but less remembered, as you're arguing, near constant resistance to that power and wealth. How has disorder been as much a part of New York's history as social order?
That's actually a very interesting set of questions, because I don't think you can separate them. I think they're intertwined with each other. And what we discovered when we were working on this book was that moments of unrest are always leading to moments of kind of the reassertion of an order. And sometimes that order is changed, it's transformed in certain ways, but order always reasserts itself, which then sets the stage for kind of the next round of tumult and upset. So I think trying to understand the city as something of a dialectic between order and disorder is a very helpful way of understanding it. And yet much of the work has been more on the side of, you know, the construction of the order of New York City. And so it's been, for us, quite enlightening to learn just how central moments of riot and other kinds of unrest have been in the making of the city as we know it.
Right. And you argue that places are produced, actively produced from all that tumult and revolt and counter-revolt, or the reaction that happens following the revolt. And so this is an intrinsic part of understanding how the city came to be what it is. You also argue that moments of revolt, as well as very much the reaction that they inevitably bring down upon them, illuminate the geography of power in the city, whether it's based on class or race or ethnicity. Can you tell us exactly what you mean by that?
Sure. One of the ways that we frame our argument in the book is through an argument by Alan Locke, who's often called the Dean of the Harlem Renaissance. And after the 1935 Harlem riot, he argued that riots were like lightning flashes that illuminate the structure of the city. And I think he's really right about that, that those moments of unrest show what the power structure looks like, shows who's in control and how tenuous their control might be, who the order serves and to what end and what purpose that might be. But it also shows the ways in which any time that there is, whatever that city structure is, if we're thinking about it sociologically or geographically, whatever that structure is, when there's a moment of unrest, of riot or of rebellion, then all of a sudden the ways in which the kind of hidden ways in which power works within the city become exposed, either through the reaction of the authorities or through rioters and activists and others themselves, who quite often after the fact are able to show what it is that led to this moment of unrest and what it is about the ways in which those in power wield their power, or sometimes fail to wield their power, that kind of shapes everyday life without us paying that much attention to it.
Is there any danger in focusing, though, in these moments of rupture, which, although you're arguing that in the history of New York City that there's been near a continuous rebellion, but of course it's not necessarily happening every single day. So there are more days, more times when people are not actively revolting than when they are. And is there any danger on focusing on those more exceptional moments?
Oh, absolutely. And so we try and make the argument at both at the beginning and the end of the book that there's a real danger in both the way we wrote the book and in anyone reading the book of placing way too much weight on these moments and losing sight of all of the organizing and other activities that go into making a moment of unrest possible or recovering from it. Because even those who are right in the middle of it, who might be the most benefited from a moment of rebellion, don't always know what they're doing at a particular moment. But the ground has always been prepared in some way or another. And so the way that this really came home to me was I was trying to write the afterword to the book, and it was early February of 2017, right when Trump announced the Muslim ban, and everybody flooded to airports around the United States, but particularly in New York City, to JFK, it was a quite remarkable moment of unrest in many ways, of resistance, and the New York Times, quoting Michael Moore, say that this protest at JFK Airport came out of nowhere. And that's absolutely wrong. It, of course, came out of 400 years of history, as we argue, but more immediately, it came out of years and years and years of organizing by immigrant rights groups, anti-racist groups, and so many others who were ready to respond instantaneously when something like this happened. And so we were able to trace it most directly to the 2006 immigrant rights protests. But there's a really much longer history than that. So there's a real danger of overlooking that kind of lesser seen politics. And so we point to that, but we also wanted to make the point at the same time that we can't ignore these moments of unrest, as many histories do.
And one of the things that you do by looking at the moments of revolt and riot is you examine the ways that these moments, which often when they're happening are bemoaned by people, including those who might be sympathetic to the cause of the people revolting, who wring their hands and say, well, this is terrible. People are burning down the places that they live, that there will be terrible consequences to this, and nothing will be gained from these moments. But you and your fellow authors in this book, Revolting New York, argue that actually these moments produce all sorts of outcomes, some which may indeed be negative, that is the crackdowns from the powers that be, but also actually often force tremendous change.
That's true. And I don't think any of that, you know, what the outcome of any kind of moment of unrest is going to be is entirely predictable in advance. And certainly not in the short term and not necessarily over the long term. So if you think about the 1977 blackout, when you know the city just burst into flames almost instantaneously, this giant kind of upwelling of really inchoate anger on people's behalf when the lights went off. And you know, this massive wave of arson, which fit into a longer wave of arson that was hitting the city at the time, but this massive wave of arson, of looting, and so on and so forth, which destroyed whole neighborhoods. And often, as you were just saying, the neighborhoods in which the people who were themselves directly involved in it lived. And there is really no, it's hard to make sense of that moment. It's very hard to make sense of that moment, except as this moment of just kind of pure rage and then the opportunity to express it. But the long-term outcomes of that were many, some quite awful, transformations in policing, for example, that led to a deepening of the racist practices of policing, I think. Some of them much longer terms, but more more positive, including this kind of shock of recognition by city authorities, middle class people, and many, many others that things were just totally messed up on the streets and in the neighborhoods of New York City. And therefore, a lot of energy towards reform and transformation. And then also in the long term, the riots themselves is kind of the low point in New York City's disinvestment in the 1970s, prepared the ground in many ways and in quite unpredictable ways for New York's total hyper-gentrification. And so ground zero of the rioting during the 1977 blackout was Bushwick, which then becomes the real center of gentrification by the first decade of the 2000s. So that's just one example, and we can see that across the whole history of New York City.
Indeed, and I'd like to ask you about some of that history. Starting with the 17th century uprisings by the Mansi against the Dutch occupation of Manhattan, what were the circumstances of the occupation, and what did the revolt lead to, a key moment in the production of the place that we now think of as New York City?
So all through the 1630s and 1640s, there were ongoing skirmishes between the Dutch authorities and settlers in colonialists in what's now Lower Manhattan, New Amsterdam at the time, and various indigenous groups who were resident on Manhattan Island itself or across what's now the Hudson River, the North River, as it was called by the Dutch colonists at the time, in what's now New Jersey, or those who live in what's now Staten Island. There were just these constant skirmishes over territory, over land, over loss of livelihoods, over hunting privileges, over disagreements about what was really bought from Native Americans at different times, whether it was the land itself or just rights to use the land, and all of those sorts of things. And there's this constant skirmishes, as well as massacres by people on both sides. And it was a quite bloody time in New Amsterdam. And during some of those massacres, the violence was just extraordinary, certainly to our kind of contemporary senses of you know, whole villages of Native Americans being wiped out with all the children being killed. And then retaliatory attacks by the Mansi and other Native groups on Dutch colonists around a whole, as I said, a set of different issues. And the immediate kind of cause of what we call the Revolt of the Mansis in the 1640s were a series of abrogations of what Mansi natives thought were a set of agreements about how the land was to be used between the incoming settlers and themselves, as well as rumors of rape, of other deprivations. And with that, then, there was just a series of ongoing raids, basically, between Native groups and then colonists and the militias and so forth, fighting back and vice versa. The end result of all of those was that the tenuousness of New Amsterdam as a Dutch colony became even more tenuous. And it became an enormously expensive colony for the Dutch to maintain and to defend, and in many ways, therefore, paved the way to the transfer of New Amsterdam to the British in 20 years later, basically.
I'm speaking with Don Mitchell, who is co-editor of Revolting New York, How 400 Years of Riot, Rebellion, Uprising, and Revolution Shaped a City. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So after the region was passed over to the English, what happened in terms of the significance of what was to become New York City for slaveholding?
What many people don't know, or if they ever learned it, have since forgotten, and I certainly didn't realize this as I embarked on working on this project, New York City was, in the early 1700s, the second largest slaveholding city in what becomes the United States in the 13 colonies, after Charleston. There was a massive slave population there, as well as a very large free black population. And slaves were absolutely essential to the early English colonial political economy. And they were also often quite militant. And so in the early 1700s, in 1711, there was a very large slave uprising, which a slave revolt, basically, which led to the death of a number of British colonists, but as well to a whole series of reforms in law and in policing, rules that made it illegal for African Americans, but they weren't African Americans yet, for blacks to walk about at night without a lantern. So this is about early surveillance, right? Not more than two, I think it was, could gather at the water pumps, the tea pumps as they were called, at a time, because that's how information was exchanged. And yet, even with all of that, there were still places where slaves and free blacks and workers who were not enslaved, white workers who were not enslaved, what were known as Spanish Negroes, who were basically Shanghaied people from Spain who were indentured and sent to work in the sugar plantations and on the ships and so forth. There are places they would hang out, like in the tavern, some of the taverns along the wharves and so forth. They'd also exchange a lot of information all the way up and down the coast and into the Caribbean. And so there was these incredible networks of knowledge among slaves, non-slave blacks, other workers who were often allied with the slaves and free blacks and so forth. And this was a constant problem for the landowners, for other colonists in Manhattan, to the point where they were always afraid that there were Negro conspiracies, as they would call them, afoot. And in 1741, one of these conspiracies seemed to come to life. There's a lot of question about what really happened in 1741, but there was a whole series of fires in a place that was quite prone to fire, but a whole series of fires in the spring of 1741 that led landowners and authorities in Manhattan to think that there was a slave uprising at work, and a very big one. And there's a good chance that there was, and it probably was. And this led to this massive crackdown on slaves and free blacks, and the hanging, drawing and quartering, burning at the stake of dozens of black men and women, as well as an Irish innkeeper and his wife and daughter, a number of others as well, and the transportation of hundreds of others out of Manhattan to elsewhere in the slaveholding regions to try and break up these conspiracies, and a real sense that a new kind of order had to be put in place, a new, much more repressive sort of order to control slavery during that time. And so there's this long history of struggle between slaves and slave owners and others who were involved that shaped the early years of New York City through the Revolutionary War and into the 1800s. Slavery did not end in New York City until 1827, quite late compared to other places in the North. And so during that whole period, there was constant unrest by slaves.
And as you and your fellow authors write in Revolting New York, throughout the 19th century, there was a great deal of upheaval, and the dialectic that you've been describing of revolt and then repression. But of course, not all forms of revolt from below are liberatory. And so racist violence has also been part of the picture of upheaval in New York and elsewhere. Can you tell us about that story, especially as it relates to the 1863 draft riots?
Sure. There's prehistory that should go with this as well, which is that, you know, well before 1863, New York becomes a destination for working class Europeans who are being recruited to work in the factories that are beginning to be developed there, in the longshoring industry, and in all kinds of areas. And so it is, as you know, we think of New York City, an immigrant destination. And there was a great deal of competition between slaves up until 1827, or I should say slaveholders until 1827, free blacks before and after the final manumission of slaves in 1827, and working class whites, Europeans most particularly, and folks from what becomes Canada and so forth. A great deal of competition over jobs, over living space, and so on and so forth. And conditions in the growing immigrant and black quarters were often terrible. Workers and other people of power were not averse to setting different castes and classes, ethnic groups, religions, and races against each other. It was often to their profit to do so because it helped break up any kind of working class solidarity. And so it often helped to foment racist violence or just kind of sectarian violence between Protestant and Catholic Irish, for example. So all during the period, the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, New York is an amazingly violent place with a huge amount of sectarian warfare almost going on, as well as lynchings and other acts against African Americans. And much of this then comes to a head in 1863 during the Civil War, when a new draft law was going to be put into place. And one of the things that a lot of working class whites were upset about was that they felt that they were being drafted into what was clearly a very deadly war, to fight to free African Americans, who many of course thought were inferior to them, to free African Americans to become competition for them. And then on top of that, the draft law allowed anyone with $300 to buy their way out of the draft. And so those two things together, and a lot more actually, led to a whole series of actions around the city as the draft was about to start in June, I think it was. It could be July of 1863. And in a whole series of parades, protests, and attempts to stop the draft. And so the draft riots begin in many ways as a class-based riot of people really upset about this exemption for people with money from being drafted. But it becomes very, very quickly a race riot, or more accurately, a racist riot, in which whites start going after African Americans and lynching them, shooting them, and otherwise torturing them when they could catch them. African Americans would often fight back, of course. A lot simply fled the city as quickly as they could. And the New York City government was very slow for lots of different reasons. Some is, I think, just a reluctance to act. Some of it is just incompetence. Some of it is rivalry between different political factions. But very slow to react, to bring in a police that won't aid and abet the rioters who are attacking African-American people, and to call in the National Guard, which was in fact very difficult at the time because many of those in the New York militia were in Pennsylvania on their way back, if I'm remembering my timing right, on their way back from Gettysburg. And so the riots raged for 4 days, and in those, they're the deadliest riots in U.S. history, and I believe they remain the deadliest riots in U.S. history. And they became, after they begin as a class kind of riot, they become an attack on black people. And part of it is this out-and-out racism, but some of it is this sense of a war that is being fought to create a competition for working class white people whose hold on their jobs and in this city is already tenuous. And so there are a lot of complex forces that come together that create this incredibly violent moment.
Well, of course, as you're saying, there's some singular aspects to what took place during the draft riots, including the fact that it was in the middle of the Civil War. But you write that throughout the history of New York, and certainly through the 19th century, that there was little hesitation when those in power saw it warranted to deploy the military and certainly the police, to put down revolts. Tell us about that and whether that extends into the 20th century as well.
It's a really remarkable story. The willingness to use military force against the residents of New York City is incredible. So all during the 19th century, even if they were often didn't do very well, but all during the 19th century, authorities would call in first, I think it was the 7th Regiment and then the 27th Regiment. Its number changed at one point, and off the top of my head, I always mix it up. But they would call in the military, which was a voluntary army. It was usually white, usually middle or upper class people who were involved with it, who saw it as part of their duty to perform that sort of service. They drilled all the time. It's what many of the parks in New York City were built to allow for, is the military drills of the militia. And they would be called in often for things that you think of as, you know, very slight, like a plan Protestant Irish to march from a stronghold on the west side of New York City in what's now kind of the Midtown area, north up to basically the Upper West Side for a commemoration of the Battle of the Boyne, which is a big day in the Protestant calendar. And the military would be brought out and would have very, very little reluctance to open fire and kill people. And it was just part of the process of revolt in New York City in the 19th century. And for many of us, as we're looking at this, it was kind of startling just how willing the government was to use the military to kill people, to kill residents of New York City. Often siding either with employers, as in the trolley strikes of the 1880s and the 1890s, or with particular factions of the working class or the political machine, like with Tammany Hall and so forth. But they were constantly being deployed. So not only in the draft riots in 1863, but in some riots in the area that's near Cooper Square now, in 1848, which was ostensibly about Shakespeare and the nature of a play being performed, but was really about the rivalries between Irish and other immigrant groups in New York City, and very much about political power in City Hall. Or so the military would be brought in for the smallest causes or the biggest ones, and would often open fire. And if you read the newspaper articles, you know, just kind of offhandedly, they would say, you know, 8 people were shot during the unrest yesterday, shot and killed during the unrest, as if it's a normal occurrence. And that continues into, I think, the 1880s or 1890s, and begins to change with the Progressive Era in many ways, with reforms in policing, with reforms in the sense of what militias are for, all those sorts of things. But I think mostly reforms in policing, with the professionalization of policing that happens beginning in the 1890s or into the 1910s, that the military is called out less and less frequently. And by the 1935 Harlem riot or the 1943 Harlem riot, while the National Guard is called out, their role in many ways is simply to patrol the streets. And by the 1960s, the 1964 Harlem riot, for example, or the anti-war unrest at Columbia, while again the National Guard is called out, and at times they can be quite brutal in ways, you know, that as we think about things now, they rarely open fire. And so there was a shift, with shifting in policing, shifting in kind of the sensibilities of how to go about maintaining order and so forth.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking today with the co-editor, along with the late Neil Smith, of Revolting New York, How 400 Years of Riot, Rebellion, Uprising, and Revolution Shaped a City. That's published by the University of Georgia Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Don Mitchell is professor of cultural geography at Uppsala University in Sweden and professor emeritus at Syracuse University. So in the 20th century, the history of upheaval, of revolt, continued. And you mentioned race-based riots. Harlem riots in 1935, in 1943, in the 1960s, 1964. Tell us about the upheavals that were generated by concern or outrage about race, and those also about class and the degree to which they crossed over.
Probably one of the most interesting race riots was in 1900, when a young man by the name of Arthur Harris came out of a saloon, which is where the New York Times building is now, in fact, and saw a man accosting his wife. So Arthur Harris was black, and as was his wife. And so he stabbed the person who was accosting his wife, who turned out to be a police officer who was not in uniform. And then a few days later, the police officer died. This led to three nights of rioting that, as one newspaper reported, only ended when the mayor banned all white people from entering the Tenderloin. But what's important about that riot, as kind of a prehistory of the Harlem riots, is that riot, like the 1863 draft riot, were attacks on black people. And they're very clearly attacks on black people by white people, including the cops. And in the 1935, 1943, and 1964 riots, which are often called, or almost always called, race riots, the African Americans and Puerto Ricans and others who were rioting were hardly ever attacked people. They almost always attacked property. They attacked property. Sometimes there's an anti-Semitic piece to this, because they often targeted property owned by Jewish shopkeepers and so forth. But they particularly targeted shops that were owned by people who didn't live in the neighborhood or were perceived as gouging them and so forth. In each one of these riots, the spark was, and this will be no surprise to any listener, I don't think, the spark was police violence. The police apprehending someone and then beating them up or shooting them. In the case of 1964, in 1943, policeman basically hitting a guy on the head with a billy club and then shooting him in the back. And so in each one of these cases, the rioting develops actually very, very quickly after each of these moments of police violence, and spreads throughout Harlem, into Spanish Harlem, into sometimes the African-American neighborhoods, growing African-American neighborhoods in Brooklyn and elsewhere. And in each case, it's property that is targeted. And it's very clearly property that is being targeted. So one of the things that we found in the book is that there is a real distinction that we need to understand when we think about race riots, that when it is whites attacking blacks, they are attacking blacks. When it is blacks uprising or rioting, they are attacking property. And that's a crucial, crucial distinction that gets lost in the way that we think about what rioting is, what it means, and what the grievances are all about. So what became clear in those three riots of Harlem was the way in which the uprisings were certainly about that moment of police violence, but just as much about the grievances of living in basically a place that is constantly being disinvested, that is operated through a whole series of racist practices in terms of housing, redlining, and all of that, and policing, and within which the merchants and others and landlords are understood basically to be colonists. And so there's this sense of the oppressed fighting back. And this was maybe explained the best by a mayor's committee in 1935 in the wake of the riot, which pointed out that for many of the rioters, what they felt they were doing when they were taking things from stores, when they were looting, was getting what they long deserved, but which had always been withheld from them. And so there was a sense that these were redistributional uprisings as well, that the long history of exploitation and oppression was being redressed through them. And that's what, you know, official government reports were arguing at the time as well. And I think that they're right, that they are redistributional in that sense.
So hence they were about race and class at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. They were about race and class at the same time. And those are I think, in many ways indistinguishable. I mean, they're obviously distinguishable, but they're indistinguishable in the ways in which the social fabric of New York City operates, that race and class map onto each other very, very tightly. And we can't talk about one without talking about the other.
The period of the 60s transformed the country, swept through the United States. How did the grievances and concerns and injustices that drove people into the streets elsewhere in the 60s manifest in New York in its particular context with its particular history in that period?
There were a couple of things that went on in New York that I think set it apart a little bit and put it right in the center of everything that was going on. There was, of course, a whole lot of anti-war activism, anti-nuke activism in the early 60s, pacifist activism from the 1950s. All that was always there. But as unrest develops, over the Vietnam War, over in relation to the civil rights movement, and so forth, a couple of things happen. One of them is that, as in lots of places, university campuses become real flashpoints. And the one that everyone knows about, and with good reason because it's important, is at Columbia University. And at Columbia, it wasn't just about the war, although that was important. The kind of research that the university was doing for the Defense Department, which was exposed by someone who just found some records basically in the library showing what they were doing, led to a great deal of unrest and organizing. So it was about the war, but it was also about Columbia's position between the growing wealth of the Upper West Side and the continuing to be exploited Harlem. And this became clearest in the university's desire to build a new gymnasium in Morningside Park. And this gymnasium was going to be on several floors and kind of cascaded down the hill into Harlem. And at the bottom, there was going to be a community access, which is basically one door that allowed people who lived in Harlem into the building, but only into parts of the building, like the lower floors. And all the luxurious stuff was going to be in the upper floors for the Columbia students. And so activists were able to link up the kinds of exploitative expansionary processes of the university with the ongoing exploitation of people in Harlem and kind of the growing sensitivity towards civil rights, equal access, all those sorts of things, the overwhelming whiteness of Columbia and so on and so forth. And so they began working on these issues, and then together anti-war activists and mostly black and a few Puerto Rican activists took over a series of buildings in 1968, in the spring of 1968, to contest both the gym and some of the wartime activities of the university. And one of the things that's really interesting that happens then is that the African-American students who've taken over one of the halls kick all the white students out and basically develop their own occupation. This is right at the moment when kind of black power ideologies are developing. But they're also a bit worried about the middle classness of the white activists. And so white activists end up taking over a whole other set of buildings, but there still is a lot of communication between the different parts of the movement at that time. So both anti-war and the kind of the changing structure of the university, access to it, the university's imprint on historically black neighborhoods in the area and that sort of stuff, all kind of come to a head in the way that they don't quite in other cities. And you can see that then gets played out in a whole series of other university occupations around the city, which are often about access to education. So in the City University of New York system, the whole series of buildings are taken over in 1969 to try and open up access to black and Puerto Rican students, particularly students from poorly performing high schools around the city, which leads to the universities being shut down, the National Guard being called back in, a number of quite violent episodes by the cops and others. that were very much about access to education, but were also about the ways in which the world that we lived in was linked up. And so they weren't separate from anti-Vietnam War activism. People saw these of a piece. So that's one thing that happened. The other is that there was actually a very, very strong, as I think there was elsewhere in the United States, reaction to the student and other radical movements of the 1960s by middle and upper class people, certainly by capital in many ways, but also by working class whites. And this was not a particularly innocent process, but at one moment in 1971, I believe it was, a whole series of construction workers, mostly, attacked an anti-war rally on Wall Street, and just started breaking heads, basically. It led to this great big melee in the city, and with hard hats, as they were called, chasing long hairs all around the city and so forth. But what's important about that is that many of these people who were engaged in what were called the hard hat riots were themselves being organized by, and the funding for their actions was being provided also by people very closely associated with Richard Nixon's presidential administration and his Dirty Tricks Fund. And so it wasn't just working class whites hated long hairs, but that there were a whole set of political machinations going on at the same time that led to this sense by the 1970s of a split in the movement between working class whites, for example, students who were understood to be privileged, white students who were particularly privileged, and between black and white students at the same time.
Geographer Don Mitchell is my guest. We're talking about the book Revolting New York, How 400 Years of Riot, Rebellion, Uprising, and Revolution Shaped a City. This is Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So from the high point of the 60s and maybe the low point of the 70s that you're talking about, which of course has been made into an iconic moment, the hard hats versus the hippies, and projected onto the working class, not just of New York, but the United States, kind of without context, that working class people were pro-war and anti-hippie, when in fact, in America, the working class turned against the Vietnam War as well. But from that point, from the 70s, New York went through a roiling fiscal crisis, and you talked about the riots that took place in the summer of 1977. Looking back to that period, roughly speaking, marks the beginning of what often is called the neoliberal era. And it's often argued that protest and revolt has diminished during the neoliberal period for various reasons. Would you say that's fair to say about New York?
I would say that the nature of protest and revolt has shifted in the neoliberal era. I don't think it has ever faded. There have been at times diminution of violence on the part of the police, for example, against protesters, not necessarily police violence overall, but against protesters, which is a very concerted effort on the part of a number of policing theorists, policing agencies, the military, and others to de-escalate force, as they call it, and then to negotiate protest rather than to kind of ban it altogether. That era of negotiated settlement or negotiated management of protest from the really the 1970s into the 1990s has itself now been supplanted with, again, an effort by the police to much more control people's protest actions than they had, not to negotiate them, but to dictate them in many ways, and then to use the failure to follow the dictates to engage in violence. And so we're seeing an uptick in violence around protest again, I think. But during that era, there was this diminution of violence, which was very much planned in many ways. This sense of negotiation or the ability to negotiate protest and so forth.
Was that to try and prevent a backlash from a more heavy-handed approach?
Yes, I think it was. And I think it was also because, I mean, maybe this is saying the same thing, that that beating heads was seen by the end of the 1960s to not be a particularly effective policing strategy. And it tended to gain a lot more sympathy for protesters or rioters than actually not beating heads. And there was kind of a revulsion on the part of a lot of people's parts after, you know, the riots and Chicago of 1968 and a whole range of other sorts of actions that, you know, there's this kind of revulsion, I think. Maybe Wounded Knee is important in this and so forth. So, so yes, it was this fear of a backlash and so then this concerted effort to do something else, to try a different way to police. But at the same time, things like, I think what we could think of as almost sectarian violence continue, which is often race-based, but it seems much more like the sectarian violence of the 1840s or 1850s, so the liberal era. In the late 1970s, 1980s, and so forth, it was often expressed as racialized because there were a number of riots in the 1980s, or I should say actually multifaceted struggles in the 1980s between, for example, Jews and blacks in Crown Heights after a quite important rabbi in his motorcade ran over two small black children, 4 years old. And in the wake of that, there was kind of a splintering of the black Jewish coalition that had been so important during the civil rights era. And that was in many ways, it was certainly race was at the center of it. And there was a lot of racist activity that happened during it, but it was very much like a sectarian kind of struggle, like between the Catholics and the Protestants in terms of control over space, control over power, all those sorts of things. You know, who's going to have a voice in City Hall? Those sorts of things get worked out in these kinds of struggles. And the other thing that returns in the 1970s, 1980s are struggles over housing that had in many ways faded by the 1930s or 1940s, I guess. And so struggles over housing as gentrification takes over. And these were expressed in defense of homeless people, in attempts to squat particular areas, and so forth. And then police or governmental reactions to those, leading most famously to a big police riot in Tompkins Square Park in 1988 that the police actually lost, which kept the park open to people who were living in it for a while, maybe slowed down gentrification in the Lower East Side for a minute or two, so forth, but really kind of expose the ways in which questions of class and housing in the city are important. And those are issues that had faded by the end of the Depression, I think.
And then you mentioned that in the 1990s, there was a shift in policing and, of course, the rise of new movements. Of course, there was the period of Rudolph Giuliani as mayor and his zero tolerance policing. And in the early 2000s, the global justice movement, the Republican National Convention. How did New York protesters and police square off against each other in ways that made clear that at least one side was studying the other and probably both?
Yes. Well, one of the things that happens at the end of the 1990s and into the 2000s is a revival of a kind of carnivalesque version of protest, which had been very important in New York City in the early 1800s. And there's this revival of it. So there's a lot of play, but it's very serious play that is really trying to overturn the order. And in many ways, the cops did not know what to do with this. They didn't quite understand what it meant for people to have a street party, right? Or for something like critical mass to arise and to take over the streets in a way that was extraordinarily fun for a lot of people, as serious as they were. And they simply didn't know how to behave. They didn't know how to behave in the face of people who were dressed up like clowns or like butterflies in the community gardening struggles. And really brought in that sense of fun. But it was very serious fun that was being had. And so the police didn't know how to behave. And that clued a lot of people into the fact that the cops had very, very good abilities to monitor and to guess and to estimate how big a protest might be and to infiltrate often. And certainly by the time the internet develops, to lurk and to find out what's going on. And so protesters, organizers, people planning more violent actions and so forth, tended then to use the fact that the cops were watching them to constantly try and fool the cops. And so there's this game of cat and mouse going on. And what results from that, I think, is what the sociologist Alex Vitali calls a new mode of policing called command and control, where the police are going to always maintain control of the streets. And who's in the streets, under what kind of conditions they're going to be in the streets, and during protest moments, and so forth. And they will often do so in ways that are very unpredictable to the protesters themselves. So very quickly throwing up netting to kettle people, as it's called, to trap them, and then hold them there until they can get IDs and all that kind of stuff, put them in holding pens out on the piers, all those sorts of things. But in ways that protesters themselves are not expecting. Quite often, at the last minute changing parade routes, all those sorts of things. And so there's this constant game going on of the cops trying to command and control any kind of protest movement and protests themselves, and the protesters constantly trying to outwit the cops. And that has led for this kind of remarkable series all through the 2000s of skirmishes between protesters and cops and into the Occupy era over, you know, precisely where people will go, what they will do, what they can get away with, the degree to which they can close down streets or access to Madison Square Garden and that sort of thing.
And of course, that leads us to the recent present, to the explosion of Occupy Wall Street, which then inspired movements all around the country, to Black Lives Matter, to protests against Trump, of course, hails from Queens. How would you read the state of protests now in New York?
It's this moment that I think is actually quite unpredictable and maybe quite explosive. And it's not clear what the trigger might be, what kind of an explosion it might be. But I have a hunch that we're on the cusp of an era of pretty significant unrest, not only in New York City, but globally. It's not that we haven't been in one, but I think it's going to be intensified over the next years. And my sense of that comes from just paying close attention now to 400 years of history of these kinds of moments. And one of the things that is really clear in this book, and it's really remarkable, is that we were only able to find two decades when we could not identify basically violent uprising. And those were the two decades between the Harlem Riot of 1943 and the Harlem Riot of 1964. So the kind of the high point of the post-Fordist social welfare settlement in the United States, which was not free of conflict, but there weren't the same kind of violent uprisings that we found for every other decade in those 400 years. And what those two decades were a moment of lessening inequality, of some breaks on the rapaciousness of capital, on a growing coalition of human rights and civil rights and other activists, and so forth, that were in many ways remaking the social and the spatial order of New York City as elsewhere. And so, but we're in a moment where that is all broken apart. And as we all know, inequality is very much on the rise. So are the rise of racist movements and so on and so forth. And it feels, again, in my reading, like the mid-1800s, the 1850s or the 1860s, and which are incredibly, incredibly explosive moments globally, as well as in New York City. And I think we're on the cusp of something like that.
I've been speaking with geographer Don Mitchell. He is professor of cultural geography at Uppsala University in Sweden, professor emeritus at Syracuse University, and he's the co-editor with the late Neil Smith of Revolting New York, How 400 Years of Riot, Rebellion, Uprising, and Revolution Shaped a City. That's published by the University of Georgia Press. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.